One evening after supper, after the children were in bed, Kate sat back in a rocker on the porch and pulled her favorite shawl around her. The nights were getting cold.
That Hankins woman is rather pretty, don't you think?
Julie Hankins was one of the new women who had openly flirted with him.
Well, I suppose so, if you like that type, which I don't.
So you did notice her?
It'd be kind of hard not to, Kate. The way she was swishing her butt around and batting her eyes like a lost calf. A couple of those women and their daughters are going to cause trouble around here. And their husbands are trash, pure and simple. I wish they'd leave.
Matt and Morgan are near about 13 years old, Jamie. A couple of those trashy girls, especially the Hankins girls, were making goo-goo eyes at the boys. Those girls are older, and they've been to the hayloft a time or two. I want you to talk to them.
Who? The girls?
Kate didn't reply. She just looked at him with those arctic blue eyes. They got colder by the second.
Right. I'll speak to the boys.
But he didn't have the foggiest idea what he was going to say. The boys had matured fast for their age and were feeling their oats, among other things.
You just be sure you do. They're far too young to be thinking about things like that.
Are you forgetting when we were 13 and 14 years old, Kate?
Oh, that was different.
The hell it was. I had to go jump in the creek every time I got around you. Kate, you could raise the temperature in the room 10 degrees just by walking in.
Oh, I wasn't that bad, Jamie.
5 degrees then.
My, it is getting warm out here, Jamie.
You know, come to think of it, I do believe it is.
They rose as one and walked into the large cabin. As it turned out, Jamie and Kate's worries were groundless. It wasn't either of the boys who was caught with one of the Hankins girls.
Well, Abe, what brings you here? Come on in.
You best come outside, Jamie. This is news that's not proper for ladies to hear.
Excuse me.
Kate immediately stepped past Jamie and onto the porch.
Kate's a very forceful woman.
Yeah, I heard tell.
Jamie stepped out onto the porch.
I've got Caroline Hankins over to my house. She's pretty badly beaten up, and the wife says she's pregnant, too. How she managed to walk from one valley to the other is a mystery.
Caroline's only 14. Who beat her?
Her father, Cyrus. With a belt and with his fists. She won't say why.
Oh, Lord God. Matthew, Morgan, you both look after Jolene and Falcon, and I mean look after them.
All right, Ma.
Megan, get your cloak and fetch mine and come with me. We'll be over to your cabin, Mr. Goldman.
Thank you, Kate. The wife will appreciate the help. She's about beside herself with this thing.
Jamie waited till Kate and Megan had gone before asking the obvious question.
Who did Cyrus catch his daughter with, Abe?
Why, I hadn't thought of that, Jamie.
You can bet that's what this is all about.
Jamie reached inside the cabin and strapped his pistol belt around him.
Go back to your wife, Abe. I'll saddle up and ride over the ridge and find out what this is all about. Tell Kate where I've gone.
Before Jamie had put the lamplights of the settlement out of sight, he heard the sounds of a galloping horse coming hard.
Hey, hold there! Before you kill that horse!
Cyrus Hankins reined up the exhausted and trembling animal, and Jamie had a notion to knock the man out of the saddle for nearly ruining a good horse.
Get out of my goddamn way, McAllister!
You watch your mouth, Hankins, before your ass overloads it. Now you'll not lay another fist or belt on that girl of yours in this valley.
So, she did come over here.
That's right, to a safe place. Now you just calm down and tell me what this is all about.
I tell you nothing. You're not the law around here, McAllister.
You want a bet?
Caroline ain't nothing but a damned whore, McAllister. Takes after her ma, I reckon. I found her with Bob Altman in the barn this afternoon. Both of them all caught up in the desires of the flesh. It was a terrible sight to behold, it was.
Altman? He's got a wife and 4 kids. I thought he was your best friend. Where is he?
Dead. I run him through with a hay fork. I reckon he's still there in the barn. Then I'll whoop that girl to a fairly well. Now get out of my way, McAllister, because I'm a-fixin' to whoop her some more.
No, you're not, Cyrus. She's had enough. Too much, really. Go on back home and calm down.
Cyrus tried to jump his tired horse to get some distance on Jamie, but the horse was just too weary to jump. Jamie lashed out with a hard left fist and smacked Cyrus flush on the jaw, knocking the man from the saddle and stretching him out on the narrow trail. Jamie took the man's pistol and knife and led the tired horse back to the settlement, put him in a stall to eat and rest.
Who's that on the ground, Pa?
It's Cyrus Hankins. You give him some water when he cools down, Morgan. I'll be over at Abe's.
When Jamie arrived, he was shocked at the girl's appearance. Both eyes were nearly swollen shut, and her face was a mass of cuts and bruises.
Is she pregnant, Kate?
Yes, about 4 months, I'd say. She's a strong, healthy girl, so she might not lose the baby. It's just too early to tell.
It's a bad thing. A real bad thing it is.
Go wait outside, sweet, and take Jamie and Abe with you. This is woman's work. You men just get in the way.
On the porch, the settlement men lit their pipes, and Jamie told them what had happened across the ridge.
He killed Altman? I knew them movers was trouble when I seen them. I told Hannah they was. I did, but to kill someone, it takes two for a coupling, you know.
But is it Altman's child?
What do you mean, Jamie?
Something's wrong here. I sensed it in Hankins' voice back yonder on the trail. I got a notion this is darker than any of us realize.
Kate stood in the doorway.
Caroline is awake. She says Bob Altman raped her, but she's pregnant due to her father. Cyrus started forcing himself on her several years ago, threatened to kill her if she told anyone. I believe her, Jamie.
The men were shocked into silence. By now, most of the settlement had gathered around, their breath making steam in the cold night air. Nearly every man there was older than Jamie, but they still looked to him for leadership.
It's her word against his. Even back east, no jury would convict Cyrus for killing a man who raped his daughter, especially since he caught him in the act. Incest is another matter. But there's no law out here, no proper judge. I don't know what to do.
Tar and feather the bastard!
Yeah! And then send him on his way!
No! There'll be none of that. I told you, it's his word against hers. Even though I'm inclined to believe Caroline. I think she's a good girl born into a rotten family. We'll send Cyrus and his brood on their way, and Caroline can stay here. She can stay over at Ian's cabin. No point in it going to waste when there's a need.
I agree.
And I.
I think that's a good idea. Yes, I do.
Jamie, Hannah, Sarah, and I will stay over here tonight. Mrs. Goldman is about done in. You go back home and...
No. I'll stay over here just in case Cyrus decides to do something tonight. I'll sleep in the barn. I'll see Megan home and be right back.
Yes, that's a good idea. I'll get Megan.
The crowd began to slowly break up, with Sweet and Sam staying at the Goldman home until Jamie returned. If Cyrus was foolish enough to try something at Jamie and Kate's home, it would more than likely be the last time he'd ever try anything, for Megan could outshoot the boys, and Jamie knew his daughter well. She wouldn't hesitate in using a gun to defend hearth and home. The boys would probably shoot quicker, but not as straight as Megan, something that always irritated Matt and Morgan and never failed to amuse Jamie. Just after dawn, when Juan and Daniel Noble relieved him, Jamie saddled up and rode over the ridge to the other community. Cyrus's horse had come up lame, nothing serious, but Jamie wanted to keep him away from Cyrus, so he left the animal in his barn. The people in the settlement across the ridge were up and gathered all around the community building that served as a school and church. The blanket-wrapped body of Bob Altman was laying in the bed of a wagon.
If you're looking for Cyrus, Mr. McAllister, you're too late. He and his wife and kids pulled out before dawn. They was up all night, a-packing and a-fighting, fussing amongst themselves. You never in your life heard such commotion. I say it's good riddance.
You're right. How about Mrs. Altman and family?
Damned if they didn't pull out with them. Something mighty queer going on with them two families. Mighty queer.
We got Caroline Hankins over at our settlement. Cyrus beat her up bad. She's staying with us for a time.
We know that Cyrus caught Bob assaulting his daughter, and Cyrus killed the man for it. He said that you would be coming after him for that.
Oh, no. I just wanted to tell him that his horse came up lame, and I have it in my barn, that's all.
Why'd he beat the girl so?
I reckon that's something you'll have to ask Cyrus. I'll see you, folks.
Back in his own valley, dismounting at the Goldman place, Kate came out to meet Jamie.
She lost the baby, Jamie, about an hour ago. But it was for the best. She was further along than I thought. The baby was... it was not normal.
The burial?
Sweet and Reverend Haywood took care of it. They buried the poor thing quickly and unmarked.
Jamie told her about the Hankinses pulling out, with Altman's widow and kids with them.
That's mighty queer.
Yeah, it's a closed book, Kate. We'll never see him again, I hope.
Oh, poor Caroline.
She's better off without him. How is she?
She's all right. I think she'll probably be able to have more children, if she ever wants more children.
Let's go home.
For the next 18 months, the settlement on the western side of the ridge prospered and grew, while the newly formed settlement on the eastern slopes faltered and finally died. One by one, the families packed up and moved away, with most of them returning to the settled east. Four families who were making a go of it across the ridge asked if they could settle in McAllister's Valley, and they were welcomed. There were now almost 100 people living in the valley. Andrew and Rosanna McAllister were in Europe, studying music under the watchful eyes of the masters in their chosen field. There had been no word from or about Ian. The young man called Desperado and Gunman had seemingly dropped out of sight. Outside the peaceful little valley, events were whirling furiously and change was rampant. The United States was preparing to go to war with Mexico. On December 29, 1845, Texas became the 28th state of the Union. In January of 1846, Captain John Fremont reached Monterey in Mexican California. It's believed he was under secret orders to make that territory ready for acquisition by the United States. The settlers in McAllister's Valley had not seen a newspaper or received any sort of news for several months. Winter locked the valley up tight. The settlers had no way of knowing that the United States was busy moving troops around, ready to fight the Mexican army. General Rough and Reddy Taylor commanded the American forces and moved his army to the left bank of the Rio Grande River. In early spring of 1846, American troops under the command of General Worth built Fort Texas. Just across the river in Matamoros, 6,000 Mexican troops fortified the town. In early spring 1846, the Mexican commander sent nearly 2,000 troops across the Rio Grande and tangled with some 70 American soldiers on a scouting mission. Those American troops who were not killed were captured and taken back across the river into Mexico. The governors of Texas and Louisiana sent volunteers to aid General Taylor just about the same time the Mexican army once more crossed the Rio Grande to attack Fort Texas. In early May of 1846, the Battle of Palo Alto took place, with 2,000 American troops soundly defeating 6,000 Mexican troops. On the 13th of May, Congress formally declared war on Mexico and authorized millions of dollars toward the war and the immediate recruitment of 50,000 troops. General Taylor crossed the Rio Grande and occupied the town of Matamoros. In June, the Army of the West, as it was called, seized San Francisco Bay and, with the help of naval gunboats, set up blockades in Mexican ports on the Gulf of Mexico. Young Ian McAllister became a scout for John Fremont, who was instrumental in the Big Bear Revolt in California. After taking the town of Sonoma, Fremont was chosen to lead the new republic. In July, the U.S. Navy landed in Monterey and Commodore John Sloat raised the Stars and Stripes and declared California part of the United States. The mountain man, Sparks, scouting for the U.S. Army up in Montana, was asked to take a message to Jamie Ian McAllister. It was the middle of July before Sparks rode into McAllister's Valley with the message from Washington. Fontaine, a man who had become friends with Jamie down in Texas and who was working for an organization that would someday be called the Secret Service, wanted Jamie to scout the best and quickest way to California through the rough country of the Southwest. The government was preparing to send several battalions of troops into California if needed, and going there by ship would take too long. Jamie was reluctant to go, but Kate made up his mind for him. She hoped he would find word about Ian. In mid-July of 1846, Jamie saddled up and rode out on horse, heading south for New Mexico. Silverwolf had prowled all over the Southwest, and he had told Jamie the best way to cross to California. But Colonel Kearney already knew the way to California and had left New Mexico about 2 weeks ahead of Jamie, heading for the new territory. Fontaine had tricked Jamie. Fontaine figured that with two McAllisters fighting for California independence, the war could be won a lot quicker. A few days out of Taos, Jamie came up on the camp of Kit Carson. The two men had a rousing welcome and then settled down for coffee and food.
What are you doing way to hell and gone down here, Jamie?
Jamie explained his request from Fontaine.
Hell, Jamie, I just come from California. I ran into Colonel Kearney not a week ago. He knows the way out there. There's a truce on between us and the Mexicans. There ain't no fighting out there. I talked Kearney into sending half his troops back to New Mexico. Can't figure out what Fontaine has on his mind.
Unbeknownst to Carson, conditions in California were taking a terrible turn for the worse. The truce was being violated by a dozen times a day on both sides. Jamie reached Los Angeles a short time after the main army garrison had pulled out, leaving only about 50 soldiers behind. The city itself was left under the rule of Archibald Gillespie, a man who held the Californios in contempt and did nothing to hide his feelings. He was little more than a tyrant, and Jamie was riding right into a growing rebellion. Ian, having no desire to head south with Stockton to fight in Mexico, had left the volunteers and was having dinner one evening in a cantina when he looked up and met his father's eyes. The men quietly embraced and sat down to wine and food and conversation. Jamie explained to his son how he'd been hoodwinked by Fontaine into coming out to California.
Things are bad here, Pa. There's a Mexican fella named Cerbulo Varela who's stirring up trouble. This whole city could blow up at any moment. Californios really hate Gillespie.
What you want to do, son?
I think we ought to stick around and see the action.
And just maybe take a hand in it too, right?
Since when you ever backed away from a fight, Paul?
Jamie smiled and studied his oldest son. Ian was the same height as his pa, with the same broad shoulders and massive arms and chest. He was now clean-shaven and wore his hair shoulder length.
You got any followers?
Nary one. I kind of like the lone wolf. Reckon I picked that up from you.
Well, let's scout around some and see which way the wind is going to blow. Then we'll plan.
Jamie prowled the town and liked none of what he saw or heard. There was a curfew in effect, rigidly enforced by Gillespie, going so far as to forbid family reunions in private homes and arresting any Mexicans who walked abreast on public streets. Californios had taken just about all they were going to take. And to make matters worse, the Californios had no respect whatsoever for Gillespie's troops. They were some of the most unsoldierly troops Jamie had ever seen, sloppy in manner and dress and attitude. Jamie sought out an audience with Gillespie, but the man rudely refused to see him. Jamie told the clearly startled guard what Gillespie could do with his refusal. That was the late afternoon of September 22nd, 1846. As Jamie returned to his hotel, he noticed that the streets were devoid of horses, buggies, and foot traffic awful early. He put it off merely as the Californios obeying the curfew and thought no more about it.
I tried, Ian, but the man refused to see me. I suggest we get a good supper and ride out for the valley at first light.
I reckon. Maybe it's time I came back home. I have been missing the place.
Not nearabouts as much as your ma's been missing you, I can tell you for sure.
Jamie and Ian were jarred out of bed at 3 o'clock in the morning by the commotion outside. They jumped into their clothes and grabbed all their guns.
Don't go outside, gentlemen. You'll be killed. The revolution is underway.
Jamie and Ian ignored the warning. A Mexican galloped up and, seeing the men were Anglos, snapped a pistol shot at them. The round missed them. Ian cleared the saddle with a ball, and the man bounced in the street.
They're attacking the garrison! To arms! To arms!
Let's get our horses, Pa!
No, we can be more effective on foot. It's just gonna be close-in work, son. We'll fight silently from the shadows.
Father and son ran through the alleys of the town until they reached the garrison. The scene amazed him, for the American troops were more than holding their own and slowly beating the attackers back.
There's Varela.
Ian lifted his pistol, but the leader of the uprising ducked into the shadows.
There's only a handful of them. The troops are holding. Let's get back to the hotel and pack up.
My
might not prove to be anything to worry about.
But Jamie was wrong. After the brief battle at his garrison, Gillespie immediately ordered all Anglos to arms and closed up the town tight. No one out and no one in. The Californios began digging up weapons they had buried when the Anglos took power, and the revolution was really on. Commander Gillespie sent a messenger to the hotel to tell Jamie that he would see him now.
You tell him to go to hell.
I can't tell him that.
Then tell him you couldn't find me.
By that night, some 500 armed Californios had gathered at an old Mexican military base about a mile from the American garrison. The Californios were under the command of a professional soldier, Captain Jose Flores, a calm and deliberate man who harbored a deep hatred toward the United States. His second in command, Lieutenant Gomez, despised Americans even more than Flores. He'd been wounded at the Alamo and had lost several relatives there, not to mention a lot of dignity and a promotion. He went straight to Captain Flores when he learned that Jamie McAllister was in town. Flores ordered Jamie found and publicly hanged to break the spirits of the Americans. But a Californio who knew that Jamie was a fair man who had no hard feelings against people of Spanish descent learned of the order and made his way to Jamie's hotel.
You must flee, Señor McAllister. The orders are to find you and hang you.
Gracias. But that's been tried before, and I'm still walking around and breathing.
Jamie charged all six of his heavy caliber pistols and both rifles and blew out the lamp. Ian was also armed with numerous pistols and two rifles. Together, father and son waited in the darkness for the attackers to come. The streets had turned even more dangerous, for by now, hundreds of armed and angry Californios were roaming the town looking for Anglos. Gomez, leading a dozen men, rushed into the lobby of the small hotel and charged up the stairs with several of his men in front of him. Jamie and Ian were waiting on the second floor landing. Six of Gomez's soldiers were either killed or badly wounded during the first few seconds, turning the landing slick with blood and creating panic among the living.
Retreat! Retreat! We'll burn them all!
Jamie and Ian rushed back to their room and grabbed up their saddlebags before the gun smoke had cleared. They headed out the back way.
Light the torch!
Jamie and Ian squatted in the alley beside the hotel and watched as the first torch was fired into life at Gomez's command. Jamie lifted a pistol and put a ball into the man's guts. He doubled over and dropped the torch, setting another man's britches on fire. Lieutenant Gomez took what men he had left and got the hell out of there. Before dawn broke, Jamie and Ian made the livery and managed to slip out of Los Angeles without getting shot. The war would drag on, with both sides taking limited casualties for about 4 months. The American flag was finally raised over Los Angeles on January 10, 1847.
You knew that Wesley Parsons and Winslow were in Los Angeles, didn't you?
They were, Paul. I got there too late. How'd you find out?
Same way you did, I reckon. I asked around.
Paul, I got no more hate in my heart. I want to see Ma in the valley again.
Then you go do that, boy.
You talk like you ain't coming.
You go on home, boy. I got some wandering to do yet.
But Ma...
She doesn't expect me till spring, Ian. I've stayed close to hearth and home for 2 years. He'd probably faint if I came back this soon. Besides, you might get a real surprise when you push open the door to your cabin.
What do you mean, Paul?
Ride on home and find out, boy. Tell your Ma I'll see her come the spring. And you too, I hope.
Good show, everyone. Actors and actresses out of costumes immediately and make sure you hang them up. And no one leaves for the party until the set is struck.
Miss LeBeau, permit me to say that your performance this evening was simply outstanding. Your talent is surpassed only by your loveliness.
And LeBeau blushed furiously and hid the lower half of her face behind a tiny fan.
Oh, why, sir, you are much too kind.
Please forgive me for being a bit forward, Miss LeBeau. But since the play closed here in Charleston this evening, and I could not bear the thought of your leaving South Carolina without my seeing you, I shamelessly admit I bribed the stage door guard to let me in. Miss LeBeau, would you have dinner with me?
Anne thought fast. The play was moving west the next day, and she had absolutely no desire to travel west of the Mississippi River. And because of her temperament, which some members of the cast had compared to an enraged grizzly, and was having trouble finding directors who'd put up with her frequent temper tantrums. Anne knew all about Court Woodville. She'd been aware for days that the young man was interested in her. Anne had investigated Court Woodville very carefully and very thoroughly. Now, here he was, the goose whose family laid the golden eggs by the bushel basket.
Why, Mr. Woodville, I would be delighted to have dinner with you.
Miss LeBeau, my heart is so filled with happiness, I fear it might burst with joy.
I'll be ready in half an hour, Mr. Woodville.
I'll count the seconds, Miss LeBeau.
Anne found her brother Ross waiting for her in her dressing room.
We've just been fired from the cast, Anne.
Anne peeled out of her dress and shrugged her pretty shoulders.
No matter. Court Woodville just took the bait, swallowing hook, line, and sinker.
The fool that's been in the audience every damn night we've played this town?
Yes, he's quite attractive, though somewhat of a simpleton. But his family is one of the wealthiest in all of Virginia, if not the richest.
This could be our ticket, Anne.
Don't you think I know that? Now get out. I have to bathe and dress. I'll see you back at the hotel.
Her brother gone, Anne stripped and inspected herself in the full-length mirror. She knew she was beautiful. Her body was the color of pale ivory and flawless. Her hair was black and her eyes a dark blue.
Tonight's the night, Anne. Play your cards right and you're set for life.
Everything to your liking, Mr. Woodville?
Yes. Another glass of wine, Miss LeBeau.
I simply couldn't. This coffee will be fine, thank you.
That will be all for now, Henry.
Thank you, Mr. Woodville.
I can't bear the thought of you leaving. I just can't.
Well, I really don't know what I'm going to do.
What do you mean, dear?
I have 6 weeks before I have to leave for New York City, and my brother and I don't have the foggiest idea how or where we want to spend those weeks.
At Ravenswood.
At where?
Anne LeBeau was a sly one. She knew all about Ravenswood. It was the largest plantation in all of Virginia. Thousands and thousands of acres and hundreds of slaves.
Our plantation. Oh, we'll have a grand time, Anne. And my parents will love you.
Anne played him like a bluefish on a line. She hesitated, frowning. Court took her soft, perfumed hands in his, which frankly were just about as soft as hers.
It's settled. I will not take no for an answer. And it is my fervent hope that once you see Ravenswood, you'll not want to leave.
Jamie put the war behind him and headed north. He didn't dislike California, but it was too settled for him. Jamie liked the wild country. He liked to go to sleep listening to the wolves howling and the coyotes yipping and yapping. He felt better once he was in Northern California. And better yet, when he crossed over into the territories. The nights were getting downright cold, the days crisp, and for 3 days he had known that someone was dogging his back trail. They, and he was certain it was more than one, were laying well back and had shown no signs of being hostile. But Jamie had a bad feeling about it in his guts, and Jamie had long ago learned to trust his instincts. Jamie saw a horse's ears prick up and felt the sudden tension of the big animal. He touched his heels to horse's flanks and jumped him off the trail into the timber. Jamie left the saddle and let the reins dangle. He grabbed his rifle from the boot and slipped into the brush, heading back in the direction he'd come, for the shot had come from behind him. He found a good position and bellied down on the cool ground. He didn't move. Somebody down there would make a mistake sooner or later, but it wouldn't be Jamie. Finally, he caught a small splash of color that didn't fit in with the terrain or the foliage. After a few moments, the color moved and became larger. Now Jamie could make out the chest of a man. He hesitated, then lifted his rifle and sighted in. The man toppled over backward and lay in a still sprawl.
I told you Perry didn't get him.
We sure got Perry. Now what?
We wait. He's just a kid. He'll make a mistake.
Jamie realized they thought he was Ian. Then he caught movement off toward his left. Somebody was trying to circle around. Jamie began to stalk his stalker. For a man of his size, he was soundless in the timber, moving like a ghost. He came up on his prey and clubbed him on the side of the head. The man dropped like a stone. Jamie trussed him up and then slapped him into consciousness. He opened his eyes to feel the cold steel of Jamie's razor-sharp bowie knife on his throat.
As any fool can plainly see, I'm the boy's pa, and I don't like people shooting at me. Now, I would have to say that you fellows made a really bad mistake. What you think about that?
Don't make no difference. There's gold on your head, too.
Howard, watch it! The kid's moved! I think he's after you!
Wrong! I've got him! And by the way, my name's Jamie. Ian's my son.
Oh, shit.
McAllister! Don't hurt Howard. He's my brother. You hurt him, and by God, I'll trail you straight into hell if I have to.
Jamie suddenly rose, picking Howard up as if the man were a child, and flinging him down the slope. Howard bounced and slammed into rocks and trees. Jamie quickly shifted positions back to his original spot. Howard's brother momentarily exposed himself, and Jamie snapped off a shot.
Shit! God damn you, McAllister!
Jamie raced back to horse and led the animal a few hundred yards into the brush before mounting up and quietly riding out. They followed. An hour later, Jamie sat horse in the timber and looked with a disgusted expression in his eyes as the men pressed on after him. For a moment, Jamie debated whether or not to just lose the men and go on about his business. Then he thought of home and Kate and all the kids in the Peaceful Valley. If he didn't stop the manhunters here, they'd surely come into the valley. He slid off horse and took his rifles. He got down behind some fallen logs and waited. It didn't take long before he saw the bounty hunters slowly making their way up the hill on foot. He shifted position until he found an upthrust in the rocks. He sat down, settling his broad back against one huge boulder that seemed so secure it must extend all the way down to bedrock. Jamie put his feet against the huge boulder in front of him and began pushing. The rock began to teeter under the strength from Jamie's legs.
Yeah!
Jamie pushed as hard as he could, and the rock gave way, slowly leaving its perch and rumbling downhill. As it rolled, it dislodged others, and soon a minor avalanche was sending tons of rock down the slope, destroying anything and everything in its path. Jamie sat quietly with his back to the boulder and thought things through. There must have been 10 or 12 men in this bunch. That meant to Jamie's mind that somebody with a lot of money was posting the bounty on his son's head.
Oh, God, help me, for God's sake.
And that somebody was more than likely the rich man from back east, Evans. The big man in industry whose son had raped and killed a girl and then had to hit the outlaw trail.
Please. My leg is crushed. You gotta help me. I'm buried from the waist down. You can't leave us here to die.
Jamie was formulating a plan. There was a trading post about a day's ride from the avalanche site. Jamie would go there and start spreading the word to trappers and pilgrims alike. He'd post a letter to Kate, too. Give it to someone traveling back east, telling her what he was going to do. He felt sure she would approve.
You rotten son of a bitch! My back is broke! My kid will avenge me, damn your black heart! You'll not get clear of this!
If he had stayed out in the wilderness for the next 2 years, he would, by God, reach every bounty hunter after Ian. And if he had to wade through blood to do it, that was fine with him.
McAllister! Is you gonna help us or no?
No!
Jamie walked back to horse and rode out. Ravenswood was just as lovely as it had been described by Court. His parents, both elderly, were immediately taken in by Anne and Ross LeBeau. And why not? They both were skilled actors. Both the mother and father were glad that some female had finally taken an interest in their only son. Court was a good boy, but a bit on the foppish side. He was not a good horseman, nor did he like blood sports, never going with the other young men on hunts. But Court was an excellent businessman, having graduated with honors from the university. A gala ball was planned and held, and naturally, Anne and Ross put on a small performance and both sang. Both had excellent voices, and both were talented with piano, violin, and guitar. The gentry just loved them both. 2 weeks after arriving at Ravenswood, Court, ever the gentleman and steeped in tradition, got down on one knee and proposed marriage to Anne LeBeau. She blushed and flustered and accepted. Jamie stepped inside the huge trading post. He was big, woolly, uncurried, and unshaven. He looked mean as hell, and he was. For 2 weeks he had been on the trail of a couple of bounty hunters who had made their brags about Jamie and Ian. Jamie had trailed them here. Now the men were going to back up those brags or die. Jamie walked to a table and tossed the saddlebags into an empty chair. He took off his battered hat and hung it on the back of the chair.
A plate of food and a pot of coffee. And after I've eaten, there'll probably be killing. Anybody who don't care to witness that best leave now.
No one left. But two men sitting at a table across the room suddenly became very uncomfortable. Jamie sat.
Suit yourself.
The barkeep placed a bowl of stew and a pot of coffee on Jamie's table.
I ain't seen the old Silver Wolf in a few years, McAllister. How he be?
He's dead. I buried him up in high country.
I'm right sorry to hear that. Mac was a damn good man.
Yes, he was. A hell of a lot better than the scum who've been sent out looking for me and my boy. As a matter of fact, they're about the lowest sons of bitches to walk the face of the earth.
Now look here, McAllister. Your boy is a wanted man, legal and all that. Me and my partner here ain't said nothing about you. But your boy is a killer and the law has papers to back that up.
No, they don't. And you're a liar, Guy Neil Williams. You boasted to Edward Felker what you were going to do to me. Edward thought he was man enough to do it. He wasn't. I killed him last week down on the Mackenzie.
You're a lying bastard.
Williams rose and reached for the gun in his belt. Jamie lifted the pistol he'd been holding in his left hand and drilled the manhunter in the chest. Williams' partner placed both hands on the rough table.
I'm out of this, McAllister. You hear me? I say I'm out of it. Leave me be, man.
Jamie laid his empty pistol on the table and pulled out a fully charged one. Those sitting in the line of fire quickly moved out of the way.
I told you I want no part of this, McAllister. Good Lord, man, can't you hear?
Who is the Western agent for Evans? And don't tell me you knew nothing about either man. If you lie to me, I'll kill you.
A lawyer in St. Louis, name of Lorne. He's commissioned to handle all of Mr. Evans' holdings east of Mississippi. That's all I know about it. I swear to you it is.
Jamie reached inside his jacket and pulled out a small bag. He tossed the bag onto the man's table.
That there's money. Far more than you're worth. I want you to ride and spread the word.
What word?
As of right now, this hunt for me and my son is over. Finished. Ended. I'll give you 1 month to get the word spread. And if you tell enough people, they'll do the rest. Then you ride to St. Louis. And you tell this Lorne person that the hunt is over. I'll give him until springtime to get the word to Evans in New York City. That's about 5 months away, plenty of time. After that, all bets are off. Any man who comes after me or my son, I'll kill on sight, without a word being exchanged. And I'll know, mister, I'll know. The Indians will tell me, trappers will tell me, old mountain men will tell me, and I have friends back east who'll tell me. Now you ride, mister, and don't ever let me see you again. If I do, I'll kill you. I said move, goddamn you!
That man grabbed up the sack of gold coins and was out of there like the hounds of hell were nipping at his heels. He didn't even chance a second look at his dead friend or bother to close the door behind him.
I heard tell about Maurice Evans. He's worth millions. He set some store by that sorry son of his. He'll not take kindly to your threats, McAllister.
If he's smart, he will.
Jamie Ian and Caroline hit it off right from the start. The entire community noticed it, and to a person were pleased. And it was Caroline who told Jamie about the trouble she'd had with her paw. She left nothing out. To Ian's eyes, that made her a bigger person. He told her so, and she wept for a time on his shoulder, both of them sitting under a tree in a meadow away from the settlement. Ian McAllister and Caroline were married shortly after the first warm winds began to blow through the Long Valley. The entire settlement turned out to see it, including the now aging war chief Black Thunder and several of his tribe. Ian put his reputation behind him and took up the plow.
They're hard after you, Jamie. Word I get is that Evans got all pissed off when that lawyer man told him what you said.
Jamie poured another cup of coffee from the blackened pot and leaned back against his saddle.
How many men, Jim?
Don't know about the regular riffraff bounty hunters, Jamie. They come and go. But the word I get is that he's hired professional manhunters.
That's the word, huh? Which way are you heading, Jim?
South. I plan on stopping in your valley for some of Kate's good cooking. You got any messages?
Jamie handed him a folded piece of paper, and Jim tucked it safely away in his parflesh.
I'll see she gets it. Oh, I near about forgot. Them two that run off from your settlement sometime back? The brother and sister what done good in the theater back east?
Yeah.
I saw in the papers a couple months ago that the girl, she done married up with the richest man in all of Virginia. Quite a to-do it was, according to the paper. Her brother's done took it over the opera company there in Richmond, and the girl, she's settled down to be the wife of Gentry. Things do work out for the best, don't they?
Court and Anne had returned from their honeymoon abroad, and Court was now building Anne the largest, most lavish, and beautifully appointed plantation home in all of Virginia. Court's father and mother had retired from running the huge empire and had turned the entire operation over to Court. Ross had been named director of the opera house and stage company in Richmond and was really turning the city into a bastion for the fine arts. Many women flirted and carried on with Ross, and he treated them all gallantly. However, Ross's sexual appetites lay in a different direction.
You goddamn stupid fool! Do you know what will happen if your tastes are ever discovered?
Relax, sister dear. You know me. I'm very careful and highly selective. Besides, I'm not all that different from the man you married.
What the hell are you talking about?
But Anne knew. It was almost an effort for Court to make love to her. Already they had separate bedrooms, although that in itself was not unusual among the gentry.
You keep your hands off my husband.
Oh, don't worry. He isn't my type.
Jamie squatted down on the ridge behind scant cover and watched the men ride toward the past. He had no way of knowing for sure who they were, but he had him a mighty good idea. Come the dark, he'd pay their camp a visit. They'd be reining in for the night before long, if they had any sense. Jamie smiled at the thought. If they had any sense, they wouldn't be chasing him deep into the heart of Indian country. Jamie watched the men until the canyon walls had swallowed them, and then he walked back to horse.
Yeah.
He rode to the other side of the ridge and swung down from the saddle, watching the men find the creek with good water and graze all around. He saw what appeared to be the leader raise his arm, military style, and the men slowed, reined up, and dismounted. Jamie sat high above, chewed on a piece of jerky, and watched the crowd of men begin to make camp, again in military fashion, tents all in nice, neat rows. There was no danger of sunlight reflecting off glass, so he took his spyglass and brought the camp in closer. 28 men, with lots of pack horses and spare mounts. Their equipment was all new, and looked to be the finest money could buy. Maurice Evans's money, he was sure. And he smiled at what else they had. A damn cannon. Looked to be a 4-pounder from where he sat. After watching for a time, Jamie felt sure the men below were all ex-military men, and from the way some sat their saddles, not all were Americans. He faded back from the ridge and sought a horse, then sat down and ate some cold pan bread, washing it down with water. At full dark, He slipped down the ridge and into the creek that meandered by the camp of the men. He carried four pistols, his rifle, and bow and quiver of arrows. Now, of course, if Jamie was awake, he was never without his knife. After spending the better part of an hour listening to the men talk, he was convinced they were hired thugs, but not trash. Some of them spoke like they had more than their share of education. And there was no doubt in Jamie's mind now. They were hunting him. One of the men was definitely not a warrior. He was a rather timid-talking fellow who looked totally out of place among these brigands. Then Jamie got a shock. A man was some kind of photographer, brought along to take pictures of Jamie's dead body. As near as Jamie could see, the man didn't even carry a gun. Jamie got mad through and through. Maurice Evans was gonna post his tintype all around New York City and boast about the killing. Jamie fitted an arrow and let it fly. The man doubled and fell to the ground, both hands wrapped around the shaft of the arrow embedded in his stomach. The photographer leaped to his feet.
Oh my God! The Red Savages are upon us!
Jamie jerked out two double-shotted pistols. Jamie quietly slipped away into the night, making his way back up the high ridge. As Jamie had lay in his blankets that night, the stars winking high above him, one question kept worrying his mind. How did they know where to find him? Long before dawn cleared the dark night skies, Jamie moved his location several miles to the north of the Manhunter's camp, and for the first few miles, he had not tried to hide his trail. Now, in a spot where he could see for miles in all directions, Jamie took his rifle, stretched out on a flat, and waited. He reviewed what he'd heard in the Manhunter's camp the night before. Raleigh was the leader, and some of the men called him Major. Maurice Evans had nixed a plan to attack the settlement in the valley. The settlement was well established, and to do so would surely be highly publicized. And since Evans had been foolish enough to make his brags about what he was going to do all over New York City, the finger of guilt would point straight to him if anything happened to the people in the settlement. Just then, they became visible, riding straight up the pass as bold as brass. Jamie sighted in the lead man. The man was knocked out of the saddle. He hit the ground and didn't move. Jamie had guessed accurately what was coming next, so as soon as he had made his shot, he was off and running for horse. Jamie was safely away, smiling as he rode. For a week, Jamie exchanged no shots with his hunters as he led the men deeper and deeper into the rugged mountains of western Montana. Then he cut south. He was going to take them down into the hole, and there he would make his stand. Jamie came upon bands of Indians, trappers, and mountain men. He spoke with them, explaining what was happening, being certain to tell them of the cannon and its enormous power. He also convinced them to leave the men alone. This was his fight. Just to the scant west of the Absarica Range, Jamie found an ideal ambush spot. By now, the men were tired and saddle sore, because Jamie had been leading them on a torturous journey through some of the wildest country west of the Mississippi. They would be ready for a hot soak and rest. Jamie led them right to Hot Springs, just north of Emigrant Pass, slightly east of the Yellowstone. This was going to be quite a sight to see, and if all worked out right, he'd have the pictures to back up the story. Jamie watched the manhunters test the Hot Springs, then peel out of their stiff and stinking clothes and take to the water with bars of strong soap. While the men were having a good time in the springs, Jamie slipped into camp and stole every stitch of clothing they had, right down to their underwear. He left the little photographer's clothes out. Then he quickly helped himself to a goodly amount of their supplies. Jamie waited until the men had emerged from the refreshing waters and returned to camp. Both his hands were filled with double-shotted, heavy-caliber pistols.
Come right on up, boys. Don't be shy.
The naked men complied sullenly.
Now that's far enough. Now set up your equipment, Mr. Picture Taker, and start doing what you do.
God damn you, McAllister.
Shut up.
You take your pictures from all angles now, Mr. Picture Taker, and be sure and get their faces in their plane. I want these pictures preserved for all time.
The photographer, whose name was Clarence, took his shots from all angles. It was a time-consuming task. Jamie finally called a halt when the men turned blue.
Pack up your gear, Clarence. All of it. You're coming with me.
What about our clothes?
Well, now, Raleigh, you might have a problem there. I expect you boys will have to make you some clothes out of blankets.
Jamie pointed one cocked pistol at a man.
You, load up that cannon with a double charge of powder.
Huh?
You heard me. Do it.
Soon the four-pounder was fully charged.
Now pack that barrel full of mud and pack it in tight. Jam it in full.
Oh, God damn you.
Now run along, fuse to the fire hole. You ready to ride, Clarence?
Yes, sir.
Get in the saddle and take up that lead rope to your pack horse and ride down yonder a ways and wait. And you'd better wait, because you'd be lost as a goose in about 5 minutes if you don't.
Yes, sir.
Jamie set fire to the pile of clothing and waited until he was sure it was blazing. Then he mounted a horse, a burning brand in his hand, and rode over to the cannon.
Run, boys! Run just as fast as you can!
The men took off, stepping gingerly along bare feet, for their boots and shoes were on fire with their clothes. Jamie touched the brand to the fuse and got the hell away from there. Chunks of metal and mud flew every which way. As things quieted down, Jamie emerged from cover.
You boys have been warned. I'm giving you your lives. I'll not be so generous if we ever meet again. You boys go on back and tell Mr. Fancy Pants Evans this game had better be over. Now cover up your nakedness and get out of here. Hiya! Come on, Clarence. You're with me.
Yes, sir!
After switching back to his own horse, Jamie and Clarence rode until they reached an Indian village he knew.
You will see that those pictures get circulated, won't you, Clarence?
Friend, I despise those men back there. I'll distribute these wherever there are people, if I can ever get back to civilization.
You'll get back. I'm aiming to take care of that right now.
Yeah. Jamie explained what had happened to the chief and the people of the village. The Indians were happy to escort the little man to a trading post and protect him. And Clarence was granted permission to take some of the finest pictures of the noble red man to ever come out of the West. Those pictures would make him famous, moderately wealthy, and much sought after as a photographer. Jamie headed back to the valley and Kate, thinking that surely this would be the end of people coming after he and Ian, and he had accomplished it with a minimum of bloodshed. The news of what happened to the manhunters quickly spread all over the wilderness, from the Mississippi River to the Pacific coast, with everybody on Jamie's side in the matter. The manhunters stopped at half a dozen trading posts on their way to Bent's Fort, but the trading posts were quite suddenly and very mysteriously out of shirts and breeches and underwear, and shoes and boots. When Raleigh and his professional manhunters finally made Bent's Fort, they were a pitiful-looking sight. The blankets they had fashioned ponchos out of were ragged and coming apart, scarcely managing to cover their nakedness. All of the men were so sore from riding without saddles they could hardly do more than hobble about. Their feet were cut and torn. The trappers and mountain men at the fort went down to their knees laughing at the manhunters. Raleigh and his men endured it all in silent and deadly rage. Clarence, of course, had been to the fort and had long left for the East in fame. Raleigh and his men provisioned up, with pants and shirts and boots this time, and headed for St. Louis for a talk with Lawyer Lauren. Matthew spotted him coming. Megan rang the community bell to herald his arrival, and the entire settlement turned out to welcome him back. Sparks had been through and told him what all had happened to the manhunters, and everybody was ready to hail the comically conquering hero. All but Kate, that is. She knew that Jamie was tired of the killing. She knew he wanted it over. But those men would never forgive the humiliation caused them by her husband. and they would be back. And Mr. Maurice Evans would not take kindly to this slight against him. He would just outfit the men again, probably hire more men, and send them right back west with orders to kill Jamie McAllister and anyone who rode or sided with him.
Jamie, this time you made a mistake.
Well, I hadn't thought about it that way, Kate. But you're probably right. I did a foolish thing in the name of humor.
Yes, you did. But I do want a picture of those manhunters, though.
Kate!
I want you to be ready to go early next spring, Raleigh Hammond. I want you to find 50 men, good men, outfit them with the most modern of weapons, and get ready to ride. I want you to have your most trusted lieutenant ride west, and find western men who know the country, and who hate McAllister. While McAllister is out hunting, or fucking Indian squaws, or whatever he does when he is away from the valley, I want you to burn that goddamn settlement to the ground, and kill everybody there. Men, women, children, horses, cattle, mules, sheep, goats, and dogs. And then bury the bodies so deep they will never be found. Do you have any objections to doing any of this?
Not if the money's right.
Money is no object.
That sounds about right to me.
By the middle of February 1848, Raleigh Hammond had quietly recruited his army of mercenaries to ride after Jamie in the settlement come the spring. They gathered all up and down the western Missouri border, waiting word, well armed, with the very latest in modern weapons. They would start the ride west to the Rockies in 1 week.
You feeling that old urge to roam again, Jamie?
It was a few minutes after a beautiful early spring dawn in the Rockies, and husband and wife both sat on the porch with huge steaming mugs of coffee. Jamie reached over and took Kate's hand.
Well, no, Kate. I got no such urge. I just want to stay here with you and watch our kids and grandkids grow and be happy. And that's the truth, my love.
Age might have something to do with that.
They were both 38 years old. Kate looked as though she might be 25 at the most, and Jamie was aging just as well. People traveling through the valley were to a person astonished to learn that the young-looking couple had been married for over 25 years and had the grandchildren to prove it. This spring's travel to Bent's Fort had brought a dozen letters to Jamie and Kate, half of them from Andrew and Rosanna. Both were enjoying enormous success as musicians and had married musicians, the unions producing four children. The letters contained numerous newspaper clippings hailing their accomplishments as concert pianists. They were due to arrive back in the valley that summer. The triplets, Matthew, Megan, and Morgan, now 16, were all sparking the children of other settlers. And Megan had already announced that she'd be getting married that summer. Her beau, a gangling 17-year-old named Jim, was hard at work in his spare time building their cabin. So far, he'd managed to fall off the scaffolding once and flatten two fingertips with a hammer. Jim was a tad nervous about the wedding. Jolene, almost 14, had announced that she was going to start seeing a boy named Angus. That lasted until Kate took her out into the barn and, with the help of a belt, convinced the girl that her attempts at sparking could wait at least one more year. Angus started walking past the cabin so often he was wearing a new path. Jamie finally wearied of the love-struck lad and told him that he could sit with the family during Sunday worship services, have supper at the McAllister cabin every other Saturday night, and sit with Jolene out on the front porch for a time and hold hands. And he added, "And son, that by God better be all you grab hold of." Falcon, now 9, was already playing gunman. Jamie had fashioned his two pistols and holsters, and the boy was stalking everything and everybody he encountered. He was uncommonly quick in getting those toy pistols out of leather. The settlement now boasted 3 stores and a combination barbershop, doctor's office, tavern. It was a strange combination, but it worked for him. The tavern was actually no more than a half dozen tables and chairs. It was more a place for the men to get away after a hard day's work and talk. The settlement had a regular school, a separate church building, and a community hall. There was a road of sorts leading out of the valley and over to Bent's Fort. However, Goldman and the other two merchants still had to wagon travel to the fort to pick up ordered supplies. About the same time that Andrew and Rosanna and their families were landing in St. Louis and making plans to travel on to the wilderness, Raleigh Hammond and his army of mercenaries were riding into the area in twos and threes. They wouldn't gather until the afternoon before the raid. Most of the able-bodied Indian men in the region were gone on the spring hunt, so the mercenaries could slip in undetected and quietly gather before they were to do their dark deeds.